everybody. My name is David Phelps, and I am a recovered alcoholic. It's been the group's request that I don't have any big books up here, because they know I like to go, hey, this is a big book. And of course, I'm going to get ribbed about the pink shirt. I like to dress appropriate. Yeah. I look good in pink. That's what my kids... Well, my oldest daughter said, that tie doesn't go with that shirt, but my wife was quick to inform her that your whole year you never dress color coordinate, Caitlin, so that's okay. My sobriety date is July 22nd of 2001, so if you do the math, I've been in approximately, I believe, 6 years and 3 days. This is not my first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I see some new faces in the room, so I have to give a brief drunkologue of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'd really like to spend pretty much the whole meeting about sharing what my experience has been for the past 6 years, because it's what a ride. They have that line in the big book, being rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. I can tell you from my experience, every time I've ever been in AA before this time, it was anything but being rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. But I have a real, this is not an AA, this is not an anniversary meeting. Being a home group member here, I came here the week after this meeting started. And we had agreed from the beginning that this was not going to be an anniversary meeting. It's an AA meeting. And that means I'm here to share in a general way. I have a responsibility at this podium to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. That's pretty specific directions on what I'm supposed to be doing up here. I just got done reading the Harry Potter book, so I could sit there and ruin it for everybody or give you, but I'm not here to do any of that stuff, Yeah, you want that, right? But I can tell you this, I'm alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic and anything. There's been times in AA where I showed up where I took the term cross-addicted. Old-timers make jokes about it, lay down the cross, you won't be addicted to carrying crosses anymore. But I've been basically a chameleon in AA all the time I've ever been in AA until I got here this time. I was given some directions that I didn't have to be anything other than an alcoholic this time. And that seems to work to remove whatever has blocked me and continues to block me from God can be removed by simply being just an alcoholic, one of God's kids. I remember my very first drink of alcohol. I was 5 years old. And I had a very abnormal reaction, what I was going to consider to be an abnormal reaction to alcohol. There was a little bit of fear involved because it was my best friend. He, by the way, did turn into a drop-dead alcoholic from day one. Wasn't to be my experience. I went over to his house and he opened the fridge and got one of his father's beers. And it's a beer they don't even make anymore. It's probably because it tasted like crap. But, he popped it open and he handed it to me. And out of fear, I took a sip. And I got what I would come to consider a very abnormal reaction. I could taste the alcohol in the background. And I'm here to tell you, and testify to the fact that it didn't taste like soda. It damn sure didn't taste like candy or ice cream. It tasted foul. And I handed it back over, and out of fear, I swallowed it. But I got such a bad reaction off it, I didn't want anything else to do with it. I was a pretty straight-laced kid. I had aspirations. I remember when I was about 8 years old, I read a lot of books back then. I was into reading science fiction books, and my story is similar to Danny. I always lived in sort of a fantasy world, dreaming that I would always be somewhere else and be like a superhero or something like that. But I remember at 8 years old, I had an aspiration to go to MIT, which back in the 60s was the top technical university in the entire world, I believe, at that time. You can have that aspirations, but if you don't follow it up with the actions, it's kind of hard to get into that. By the time I got into high school, I couldn't multiply or divide, so MIT was out the door. I got kicked out of my first math class in high school for throwing a piece of paper off, and I could not multiply or divide. I didn't learn how to do that until later on in life. But it wasn't because I was stupid. I got lost in the school system, you know, and that's not why I'm an alcoholic. I remember there was a turning point in my life where I remember walking down my street at my house in Brookside, and I remember the kids that I would play with, but they were older than me, started doing stuff at my buddy's, my girlfriend's house, her older brother and his friends, and I knew what they were doing was wrong. And I remember specifically walking down the road saying, you know what, I'll never be like that. I'm never going to do that. And within, I believe, 1 year, it's a memory, 1 year later, I was doing exactly what they were doing. You know, I was trying to fit in. And my low self-esteem would cause me to take actions that were contrary to the nature I was born with, I believe. So if whatever anybody else was doing, I would do it too. Sometimes I wouldn't do that because I ran into people in the 70s who were breaking Freon lines off of the air conditioner units, and some of them were dying from it, and thank God I didn't get into that. I never got into, I never got into the huffing scene. Thank God for that, because I know people that did that are just permanently brain damaged as a result, you know. But I did stuff that was just as stupid, you know, taking unprescribed, unmedicated chemicals, not knowing how or what they're made from is pretty much stupid, you know, in my experience. But if it would make me feel better, I would do it, you know. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and drugs are a part of my story, you know. And thank God for that, too. I couldn't imagine if, 2001, if I hadn't had all those hardcore chemicals that I was doing to change how I feel, that I probably would still be out there trying to drink my way into AA. And I may or may have not ever made it in here, and I was definitely a full-blown alcoholic. But drugs made me pay a more severe price, more quicker, brought my bottom up to me a lot faster. You know, I had a pretty profound moment in 1979 when my father died. I always hung out with the older crowd, and I remember walking up that driveway and meeting my mother in the driveway, and she was just devastated that her husband, my dad, had died. And I had never experienced anybody dying before. And I hated my father. I did not love my father. I hated him. But I just, when he died, something inside of me changed. And I remember calling my best friend, who's a Vietnam vet. He's like a sponsor to me, and he'll be intermingled in this story of mine. He's like a sponsor because I've never had an older brother, so that's what I looked up to him. And I used him like I use a sponsor, you know, when I would get in jams and what to do and what not to do. But I remember I called him up, and he knew exactly what would take the pain of death away. So we went to his house, and somewhere on the way we probably stopped at a liquor store. Anyway, he got the biggest bottle of vodka that they sell, and got grapefruit juice. And I don't like grapefruit juice, but it did make the vodka palatable. And I don't remember blacking out or passing out that night. I don't remember coming to. Alcohol did something for me that night that it had never done before. It was able to take away the pain of death. That's pretty damn powerful, you know, for a 17-year-old kid to become oblivious to death, you know. Up to that point, you know, I mean, we used to, you know, I remember drinking grain alcohol and going the wrong way down Route 40 and laughing about it and going to the local toy store drunk on Mad Dog 2020. And I know for a fact there ain't no grapes in Mad Dog 2020, you know. And I remember that it was a store that's like Toys R Us, but they called it Kitty World on Maris Road. And I punched some doll that's about this big. You know, I got into a fight and argument with a doll, you know. And I ended up punching a doll, and next thing I know, they got security. They didn't have security, but apparently that night they did, you know, and I get it sorted out, you know. And but I paid a little bit of prices for that, you know. It's like I was still having fun with alcohol. And I hate to tell you, if alcohol's always been bad in your life, I don't know. It always wasn't bad for me. You know, there was a lot of damn good times drinking. You know, it eased the sense of social discomfort that I felt. You know, but then in the end, it would boomerang on me, and I could never get back. You know, I'm a classic poster boy for Alcoholics Anonymous for one reason, because I'm a real alcoholic. And when I showed up here on July 21st of 2001, you know, I was dying from it. And a lot of other secondary infections that were killing me, you know. But I went, the solution for my life at that time, I had heard all those great stories from my best friend, sponsor, Vietnam vet buddy, and he was, I used to just fall in love, and we'd get high and drunk, and I would get him to tell us stories from Vietnam, and I fell in love with that type of lifestyle, and I wanted it. And in 1979, when our diplomats got taken hostage by Iran, I wanted to kill Iranians, you know. And so the only way I'm going to be able to do that, because I'm only 17, I'm unemployed, no high school diploma, I'm going to join the military, and I did. And back then, they took anybody, literally. No high school diploma, criminal charges. It's like now, without any type of like background checks. And they paid for that a lot, because I remember serving, being in the service with guys, and all of a sudden, I'd been with these guys a year, year and a half, and their past, their criminal past would catch up with them, and they'd have to discharge them out because their state where they had been charged and they had escaped those charges came to get them. And they made the military turn them over. And being that we weren't in a war, they didn't have a necessity, and the military didn't find a need to keep them. But my military experience, my drinking just took off. If you can imagine a 17-year-old kid able to walk in bars anywhere and get served, That's if you're an alcoholic, you know, if you drink because you like the effect of what alcohol does for you, that's a good thing, you know. And I started learning how to drink, you know. I started being able to build up a tolerance, which I thought was outstanding, and I started, you know, boasting about that. And I remember coming home on leave one day, and I'm matching every. I bought a big bottle of Jack Daniels, and I'm matching everybody's shot for shot in the car, and I blacked out. And then when I came to, somebody had thrown up on me, you know, me. They had gotten rid of me, and I was on the side of the road. You know, apparently I was, you know, I'm not pretty when I throw up. And I was on the side of the road, and, you know, I the next recollection I got coming to, apparently they had come and got me and stuck me behind my neighborhood at a playground. And the next recollection I got, I'm coming to, and there's a state cop going through my pockets. And I'm only an alcoholic, but... You know, when I'm drinking, there's no filter mechanism that says if you do those other things, you'll get arrested for them. And he almost found those other things in my pocket. And by God's grace, here I am. I'm coming to, and he's reaching for this pocket, and I'm handing him my military ID and my leave papers. And the cop just took me home. I didn't pay any consequences for that. The military, after 3 years, gave me an honorable discharge, but they asked me to leave and not come back. You know? That might have been an indication of some unmanageability with alcohol. Okay? I got in trouble in every single country I went in except Japan. Okay? And the Americas knows. Japan, they never let us off the plane. It's not a civilian plane, so they didn't serve drinks. America Samoas, they didn't let us out of their airport, and they kept an eye on us. But every other country I went to, I got in trouble as a direct result of drinking, you know, which might have been an indication of unmanageability. When I start to drink, I can't stop, even back then. You know, Korea had this, I had a wonderful experience with Korea. They have this Korean moonshine that's sold legally. It's called soju, and it's got formaldehyde in it. And I used to, like, here, if you dip cigarettes in there, you can get high off of that stuff. Well, if you drink it with alcohol, you actually come to more drunk than when you blacked out or passed out. And I don't know about anybody else, but when I heard that, you know, there was a sergeant friend of mine, he Sergeant Smith, they said he got drunk one night and stayed drunk 3 days in a row from drinking that one night. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but when I heard that, I'm already there. You know, this was a year and a half, 2 years before we even went to Korea. I was there and couldn't wait to experience that, because it was just, and that was my experience. I stayed drunk for 2 days, not three. But you pay a consequence when you can't make it back to post on time. You know, all American forces, unless you live off post, are required to be at the gate no later than 11 o'clock. Now, I can guarantee you, I do not look Korean, you know. And so when I showed up at like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning at the gate with this guy that I got in trouble to within New Zealand for doing the same exact thing, We didn't look Korean. He's white, I'm black. I mean, he's black, I'm white. You know, neither one of us looked Korean, and sure enough, we paid a heavy price for that. The same exact experience happened in New Zealand, except New Zealand, there was a guy that was taking us out, six of us out, and he was giving us free booze at his Chinese restaurant that he owned. New Zealand loves American servicemen because we did a lot of stuff for them in Vietnam, when actually they should be looking at it the other way around because we were the ones that got into that conflict. But they love us, so you don't have to buy drinks if you're an American serviceman in New Zealand, you know? And they told us, they lined us up, we know you've been going off post, you know, and you're not supposed to do that. You're a guest in this country. But we'll let you go. Just don't do it again. But if you do, we'll catch you. Me and Corporal Black, we knew where we were going that night. We knew it for a fact. Four other guys apparently weren't alcoholic, you know. And sure enough, when we came back, you know, they had taken all my stuff and all his stuff and the company CP. And I paid a heavy price. I lost some rank for that, you know, that I worked hard for. You know, but it was a small price to pay. I can't turn away. Can anybody here, when you're actively drinking, turn away free booze? I see a whole bunch of heads going, no, you're just like me. You know, and that's it. No matter what the price is, I can't turn that away. It's like it's a magnet, and I'm attracted to it in some unnatural force, you know. I get out of the military, and I apply to the Delaware State Police, and I got accepted. Wait, it gets better. You know, I was supposed to take the test. That's all I had to do. I got my high school diploma in there. I learned how to multiply, divide, and do fractions. And I'm sure that I could have passed their test. I knew for a fact I could. Because I'd done all the studies through the University of Hawaii to get my high school diploma. All I had to do was take the test. And the same guy that's my Vietnam vet buddy said one day, he goes, jokingly, he said, how are you going to bust people for what you like to do? And in my keen alcoholic mind, that made sense, you know, and I just let it go. 2 years later, I was in the, I had gone back to the military because I was basically unemployed, and I was fixing helicopters. I didn't know how to fix helicopters, but that's what my job MOS said, you know. I took a flight aptitude test and got offered an opportunity to go fly helicopters, learn how to be a warrant officer and fly helicopters for the United States military. You know, Apaches and Cobras and Hueys and that stuff. And I could have done it. I barely passed the test, but the thing is, it's a 300-question test. If you get 100 on it, you pass. I got like a 101, 102, something like that. I passed. And they offered me that opportunity. 2 months later, I'm sitting in federal prison as a direct result from my alcoholism. I heard a speaker from Jersey here a few weeks ago talk about that. I dare anybody to tell me that I went to jail for any other reason than my alcoholism, because I was doing illegal things so I could drink longer. You know, it's like a friend of mine said last night, they told him when they approached him with these chemicals, they said you can drink longer on them. He never once asked them, well, what's the effect that's going to cause or what's the damage? And that's my experience too. If it could make me drink longer, if it could keep me from getting sick, that's what I would do. You know, I got out on a 32-hour furlough. I'm in a co-ed federal prison. That means there's women there. No offense. You know, you can walk to the liquor store if you can not get caught. I chose not to do that. But I figured on this 32-hour furlough, it's my very first visit. My mom comes to visit me. And all I want to do is eat a bunch of bacon because they limit that in there. And I want to get drunk because I know I can give a cream breathalyzer. But see, I'm only alcoholic, and my best friend shows up again with my mom, and I start drinking, and he's a agricultural salesman, you know, and we debate how much of that agricultural stuff I can do and get away with and give a clean urine the next day, and four hits while drunk, seeing, yeah, it's guaranteed to work, and I'm here to tell you 2 weeks later, they shit me off, my urine came up positive, and I went to a maximum security penitentiary. You know, and I'm doing time with people that the Sopranos are labeled after. You know, and matter of fact, my cellmate was considered the head of the Rochester Mafia. That doesn't make me special. It makes me like a goofball because I don't belong. You know, I really don't. I can coexist with those guys because I am a chameleon. I can fit in anywhere. I develop their mannerisms. I start talking like I'm Italian. I'm kissing people on the cheeks and stuff. You know. When I answer those guys, it's a nuisance, but I'm good to go get them coffee, and I fit in. You know, I get out on a they finally had to release me. I got my sentence reduced while I was in there. You know, and they finally had to release me. And I get out, and my very first overnight pass from the halfway house up in Wilmington, all I want to do is hook up with one of my old girlfriends, and I didn't have any other plans than that, and somebody handed me a drink, and I was off to the races, and I don't make it back for curfew call. And now I'm being woken to, come to, with two of the guards from there, getting ready to go back to federal prison. Because that's exactly where they could have sent me, because I violated the rules. And I know what the rules are because they explain them to you in depth before you get out. You know, and I can't see it. You know, I don't see that my drinking's the problem. I get out on parole and I talked about this the other night when I spoke. I don't know if you have this, but I have selective hearing. Okay? Somebody, and I'll be sober, they'll tell me something and I'll think it's something exactly opposite of what they said. This is what I could swear, and I'd actually pass a lie detector test. I swore my parole officer said, David, we know you got a problem with drugs, but you can drink. That's what I heard. And I can guarantee you to this day, if I was to go ask that man, I can guarantee you that's not what he said. But as long as I figured I could drink, everything's going to be okay. When drinking's already so much a part of my life, then I'm a full-blown alcoholic back then. But I just don't see it. And I wouldn't be able to see it for a long time. So what do drunks like me do when you can drink? You start, you know, sometimes you might drive when drunk. You know, it killed like, 48,000 people last year, you know, from drunken driving accidents, you know. And sometimes when you're out of liquor, what are you going to do? Like if you've been drinking on the job, you got to get home. So I start driving drunk all the time. You know, I start developing nasty habits like my personal favorite passing lane while drinking is the shoulder. Why? It's mine. There's nobody there, so why not use it to pass somebody? You know? These people aren't good drivers anyway, you know? And they didn't get out of my way when I tailgated them. Clear indication, you know? And so I started having accidents. Last one, I nearly killed somebody that was in my vehicle. They got thrown out of my vehicle when we hit a bush. We left four sets of tire track, you know? And, you know, I end up in AA, courtesy of a drinking and driving program, my third or fourth one, you know. And I was failing that, but the guy made me a deal. He said, last 2 weeks, you know, you're going to fail. You're not going to get your license back, but I'll make you a deal. If you go to AA, I'll give you your license back. And I came the very next day. I didn't want to drink anymore. I stopped doing those unlicensed pharmaceuticals a couple weeks before that. And about a week prior to that meeting, I'd actually stopped drinking, and I was crying and shaking myself to sleep every night. I had mild DTs. Not full-blown ones, just mild ones. And I stayed sober as a result of that for 2.5 years. March of 1992 till around the same time, 1995, 2.5 years. I took martial arts. I never could fight my way out of a paper bag, and I figured, you know, martial arts would be a good thing, and I got people that I developed that literally had put, they wanted to kill me as some of the stuff, my actions that I had done back in the 80s. So I figured I'd better learn how to defend myself. And I actually found more interest in martial arts than I did in AA. After a while, getting beat up by 15-year-olds when you're in your late 20s is kind of humiliating. They get, mind you, you knock a, this is my experience, you knock a 15-year-old that you're sparring down, they get up like that. They knock you down with the same power or greater. You don't get up like that when you're my age, you know. It takes a little while. And so martial arts didn't fill it in here anymore. Didn't fill that part of self. And I left. I was almost a black belt. I invested a lot of time, money, and I left because it didn't fill the self that needed to be filled. I didn't know that then. I just said everybody, it was so bad that the top rated master in the state of Maryland, he was one of my instructors. He called me up and begged me, please come back. You can eventually teach. I wouldn't do it. I came up with excuses. And what it really was self was being violated, was being threatened while I was there. You know, and my ego, which is my ego, is not getting filled. You know, and soon after I left that, I left AA. And the next thing, because at the end of my AA experience during that time, I would go to Westminster House and do katas outside the meeting and stuff. And yeah, that's some people I can imagine. Here's this moron out there doing martial. Yeah, you didn't see it. You weren't sober then. You know. But the thing was, is it didn't fill my ego. And the next thing I know, I'm drinking again. And it got bad toward the end of that year, and I came running back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed here the next time 4.5 years. I read my big book. I could have sworn passed a lie detector test that I did everything that was outlined in that book. And I'm here to tell you, in my experience that it is today, I didn't do half of what was suggested in that book. It's no wonder that I had to leave Alcoholics Anonymous to go get done, because if you're a real alcoholic of my type, and you don't do what's required, which is action, while you're here, you start to die inside. This is way before you pick up a drink. You start suffering from page 52 in our big book. About the second or third paragraph down, we start having problems with personal relationships. We become a prey to misery and depression. I start refocusing on everybody else being the problem. But if you've done the steps, you know that you are the problem if you're the alcoholic. You know, and I'm forced to leave AA again. You know, I used to go, I mentioned this at the, I used to go to this meeting off the Beltway. Some of you might have been to it. The average length of time at that meeting on that Saturday at 11 o'clock is about 40 years. And it's a crowd about half this size. And I would get what they said, and I would come back up and regurgitate it into my own little, and I would sound like it's my, well, I would try and sound like it's my experience. Why am I, because I wanted to be, you know, hey, attaboy, you sound so good. During that time, I sponsored one person, unfortunately for them. I'm not joking about that, unfortunately for them. I could have killed that guy with the garbage I was dishing out. You know, I left Alcoholics Anonymous because I misread a line, which I did a lot, and sometimes still do, in the big book where it says, heavy drinkers sometimes drink like alcoholics. It's in the line of where they're trying to differentiate the difference between a problem or heavy drinker versus a real alcoholic. And of course, selective hearing, selective eyesight, selective brain patterns. I interpret things in my own way. And what that said in my mind was, when I stuck a needle in my arm, that was my problem. It was never the booze. And I left AA convinced that I wasn't an alcoholic. I just was a drug addict. You know, and if I just don't do those other things, I'll be okay. You know? What happened from that point on was the mental obsession, exactly as predicted by the big book, would start to plague me on a daily basis, because you can't escape alcohol. Does anybody know anywhere in the world that you can get away and not be around alcohol? Maybe in Saudi Arabia, maybe in Iran, but it's kind of hard to look at it when there's a liquor store on pretty much every street corner at most cities. And if you're in construction, it's really hard to be around people that aren't going to drink during the day, smoke pot on the scaffold, or do unlicensed pharmaceuticals and this. I work construction, you know, and but it was a thought process. Can I drink every day? I woke up like that. And then it was, can I drink safely? Can I drink safely and control it? And then finally, can I drink safely, control it, and enjoy it? Because I don't know about you all, that was one of the greatest obsessions, of trying to control my drinking and enjoying it at the same time, because it seems like when I could control it, I didn't enjoy it. And it wasn't much of control anyway, because I could hit it one day, I'd drink one beer, but I tried to do that the next day, and I'm off to the races. And then when I'm drunk, I'm doing all my other secondary infections, which I swore, because I'm married, I took a hostage, you know? That's not her reaction, by the way. And we got kids. And I don't want to live that way. And at the very end, and this is the last I want to talk about that part of my life, is before I got here, was I was begging the creator of the universe, who I choose to call today God, and I knew it was God then, to kill me. You know, I remember saying God specifically, and I said this before from the podium, Father, let Social Security, let me have a massive coronary so Social Security will pay so my kids may eat. Because I don't know about you all, I got a handicapped wife, no disability at the time. She can't work and I'm the only breadwinner and we have a lot of bills. I have a lot of stuff and you get that stuff sober. Sober, you can get a lot of stuff, but it's stuff. And in my experience, if your happiness is based on stuff, when it leaves, you leave. yourself leads. And that's not how God intended us, I believe, to be happy. At least that's not my experience today. You know, and there's a line in To the Wise. A lot of people don't find too much use for that chapter, but there's a line in there that's apropos from my experience. It says, the armored car could not have brought the paycheck home safe enough. Anybody ever had that experience? You know? You secondary infection people probably know exactly what I'm talking about, you know? And July 21st, I went to AA in June of that year, and there was a guy came up to me and said, if you ever want help, please help. Please call me, and I will come and help you. The hand of AA reached out for me when I was visiting AA. And I'm here to tell you, all my other experiences, even though I stayed here for years, I was only visiting Alcoholics Anonymous, probably getting ready to stay here this time. Because I believe this time I have permanent sobriety. No, I'm not in the ground yet, but I am a recovered alcoholic. The obsession has been removed. I don't suffer from alcoholism. That's a mistake that a lot of the fellowship does. Read the very first page where it says Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. People don't like that. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And you know what? If you've done the steps, that's what you're all supposed to be, because that's what the outside professional help that taught this to Bill, Bob, and everybody else who founded it. Read AA Comes of Age. The doctors, they have a bunch of letters from the doctor. They call us that. That's where Bill got the term from. We've had the psychic change. It's been removed. I don't have to fight it anymore. Thank God. But I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. July 21st of 2001, it's not my sobriety date. July 22nd it is. You know, I met that guy there that night at Pace. You know, and at that meeting in the Pace building. And in my experience, I didn't get the relief that I had gotten in AA. Because I could come to AA every other time, sit in where you guys are sitting, and not have to take any action. And I felt okay, at least for a while. But see, because I believe I was in, and this is just my experience, I could be totally delusional about this, I believe I was in the end of my alcoholism. You know, I was homicidal and suicidal, and I was dying. You know, and I was going to be burned and forged in a fire of untreated alcoholism that I had never experienced before. Because sitting in AA meetings and people would start to talk about their kids and the bad stuff that happened to them while they were drinking that they would do to their kids, like the abandonment and all that stuff, I would start getting hit with my experiences of when I would go get done at night and wake my kid, my oldest kid who likes to play with lighters. You know, and I remember going and getting done one night and waking him up to watch the three younger ones. And those secondary affections, you might run through a lot of Bic lighters, you know, when you like to see the Prudential Man, the piece of the rock, you know. And not to make light of what I did, I remember going up to go get some of those secondary infections because I wasn't done. And I remember that thought that there's lighters all over the house. And then I'm going to come home to a house that's burned down and the kids are going to be dead. And how I just ignored that because the obsession was so great that I had to keep going to go get done. See, I'm a real alcoholic. I have real obsessions that don't sit there and you can't think these things through. That's a lie in Alcoholics Anonymous that is garbage. Think to drink through. Show me in the big book where it's gonna, when that obsession is on me and I'm a real alcoholic, where I'm gonna be able to think that I'm gonna have the ability to bring to the forefront of my mind the consequences that I'm gonna pay from what I'm gonna do to get done. If you're a real alcoholic, the big book says specifically you can't do that from their experience. And there was like almost 100 of them that wrote that. And that was their combined, unified experience. So I can't do that. I can't think that stuff through. But when I'm sitting in here sober, and I'm so full of guilt and remorse and shame, in AA I have to be a shoe inspector because I'm not even worthy to be here, and I know it because I belong dead. And somebody hits that, and then my mind goes off on that, and it just tortures me to death. You know? That resulted in me almost putting a truck into a telephone pole on the way to an AA meeting, cussing God at the same time. Thank God for the anti-suicide device in vehicles. Airbag? Yeah. Because I looked down at that and I had a moment of clarity You don't want to do that to your family, David. And something caused me to turn the vehicle away. You know, let's talk about recovery. You know, my experience, because it's way better than what it was like to get here. My God, I am not the same person here. Ask any of my sponsees that have felt the presence of God. Ask my family. Ask any of those people that the gift that AA has given them that I've had the privilege of being part of. Anything I say from this point on is just my experience. I don't sit up here and say any of this stuff to make you feel bad if you're not doing what I do. Because what I do is between God and me. Just like what you do is between God and yourself. You know, so don't measure what I do with what you're doing. Because it probably won't measure up, or it may be greater than I. You know, and that's not what I'm up here to do. I'm here to share in a general way what I do like today. I got a sponsor. I was given a sponsor. I did not pick my sponsor. Thank God I didn't pick somebody I could identify with. Homicidal and suicidal. That would have been a good way to die. You know, they felt pity on me and they gave me a sponsor in a meeting down in Baltimore. Harvard City Speakers. What a great meeting. This meeting is mimicked after that. You know, that's where we came about. Most of us came about with really great sobriety from being inspired from people that had singleness of purpose to carry this message. What message? The message that's carried in the big book. Not my message. I don't do my program. My program got me into mental institutions. It got me locked up. It got me drinking again from a sober state. So I don't do that, you know, and I don't criticize anybody that wants to do their program. That's between you and God. It's none of my business. I just don't have to do my program. He took me right through the steps on the way down to an AA meeting. They didn't wait to do a step a month. They took me right down to a meeting, and on the way down there, we did the first four steps on the way to a meeting. He asked me if I knew where the doctor's opinion was, and I read that book I told you every day the last time I was here. I think I did. I had no clue where the doctor's opinion was. That's pretty bad. You know? It's in the Roman numeral section. And my thing is, who reads the Roman numerals? You know? I didn't know. You know? But he took me through and he gave me the best of what he had. He passed on his experience and his time. That guy always made sure I had a seat. And he always had a car full of guys that were willing to travel with him. They told me, don't speak in AA meetings, because nobody wants what you have, Dave. And then he coupled that with, you don't want what you have either. And I can tell you for a fact, I did not want what I had. They said, but you can speak in mental institutions and detoxes. They said, you can't hurt the people with the slippers. They're highly medicated, and if you think you're getting to them, you know, they're probably peeing on themselves. And so for 5 months, that's the only place I spoke. I can tell you this, my sponsor I now have, I remember to this day, that very first time I spoke at detox, and I remember coming out of there and saying, my God, I used to be so eloquent the last time that I spoke in AA. And my now sponsor looked at me and he said, David, I heard you when you were last on, and you weren't eloquent, and you weren't passing on a message of hope. And it made me feel about that big. But thank God, sometimes in myself, I need to be put back down into a position to where I'm going to learn. And if I'm humble enough and realize that these people aren't doing it to hurt my feelings, they're doing it to save my ass and save my life and give me a life worth living. If I have enough humility, I might actually listen to what they're saying. Or I could always just be full on the default of being full of self and arrogant and saying, oh, they're full of crap, it's them, and it's not me, it's them. But it's always been me. And that's what the 12 steps showed me. We went through the steps, you know. And I'm not really here to take you through the steps tonight. Get a sponsor if you want to go through the steps. It's not my job to do that. I can tell you what happened after I went through the steps. I made direct amends to my mother-in-law while I was writing my four step. Not recommended to do. Because if you don't have the directions on how we actually make amends, you're going to cause further harm in my experience. Last thing I said to the woman, I mentioned it here last, and she was in the audience. She didn't chuckle. I said, I forgive you for everything you've ever done to me. She didn't chuckle. She was in the back. She was in the back row last year. God bless her soul. That ruined my chance. chance, because I would have been given a chance to actually make amends when several weeks later I was up to it with the directions, and I had blown it. It took 3 years before I could make formal amends to that lady, because I had to show her by my actions that I had changed. I went through something when I was 2 years sober, not quite 2 years sober, that killed me. You know, I'm not going to mention it here because it doesn't really have a place, because I don't want anybody to hurt, because there was other people involved in that. You know, but something inside of me died, and I nearly killed somebody that night that happened. And I had him underneath of me, and I tried to stab him with a serrated drywall knife, sober. And as I'm sitting there plunging down, something held my arm back, and when I looked back, there was nobody there. And I tried to do it again, and the same exact thing happened. And I threw the knife away. Sober. Something prevented me from doing something that would have... I'd still be sitting down to murder as a result of it. Thank God. I'm chalking it up to my higher power. Because I literally could have killed somebody. For the first time, probably, I could have done that. You know? It took 6 months. 6 months. I tried to work on that problem. I did it by stalking my wife. What's bad is that I'm sponsoring people at the time, and I'm actually taking them with me. And like, I remember my one guy sitting there saying, like the second or third time we're there, "David, I know you have a court order." Now he's my sponsee. He's brand new to sobriety. And he's trying to say, "You know, that's not a good thing, you know." Taking your sponsees on stalking trips is not actually that, you know? That type of behavior at the end of that period of time, when I was about 2.5 years sober, caused me to start developing insomnia. And I couldn't sleep 50, 60, 70 hours at a pop. I had such a guilty conscience because I was becoming a hypocrite. I was still praying every day and reading my big book every day, but I quit sponsoring people. And I turned my back on that. And I used AA as a dumping ground for my problems. Feel sorry for me. I never wanted to drink, but I literally went insane. I tried the Ambien the doctor had and the Sonat and all that sleep stuff. Doesn't work if you have a guilty conscience. What I was suffering from was spiritual, not medical. Because God's got a hold of me. So I'm going to pay a price for my actions. I had to go back through the steps. I had to go back. And there was stuff in the fourth step I didn't know. Like there's three places in the fourth step that you're supposed to pray. There's a resentment prayer on page 67, the top of that page. A fear prayer on page 68. And praying for a new sex ideal. I didn't know that. It's not the guy who took me through the steps' fault. I'm reading the book. It's right in the book. It says, when we ask God, that's a prayer. I was taught praying is simply talking to God. Keep it simple. Meditating is listening. I missed that. Didn't miss it going through again. You know? And then all of a sudden, I couldn't hate the people that were actually a part of what I had helped start. See, my heart's been in the right place ever since I got here this time. And I like to give, but sometimes it's not the question of giving, it's when and how to give to be effective. That's why sponsorship is good, because you might say like to your sponsor, "Hey, I want to put so-and-so up," you know, and your sponsor might say, "Hey, that might not actually be a good idea," you know. Because it's not, it says in there, and there's another line in Working with Others, it says little or no help is necessary for somebody that's really here to do the deal. And I'm not saying that sort of help isn't needed. But it has to be going over more than just me. Because I can actually start playing God again. My agnosticism can come out. That's a simple, fancy way of saying me playing God, me being director. Page 52 can be your current experience sober, having been through the steps, if you play God. That's what happened to me. You know? So I went back through the steps and I redoubled my efforts. Exactly what it says. I never got drunk. But I tell you what, the life that I lived for that 6 months was just not worth living. You know, my life started changing again. You know, I got heavily back into taking others through the steps, trying to help them to put their hand in God's hands, which I believe is what a sponsor's job is. It's not for me to dictate who or what God is to them. And matter of fact, in my experience right now as it is today, I have to ask God, because I've been through the steps so many different ways now this time. I don't know what way's perfect to take anybody through the steps. Because I can either take them page by page, paragraph by paragraph. I love doing that because it opens up the big book to me in a way every single time that it's never been opened before. It's experienced that way. But I can also take them through and be up to a fourth step in 40 minutes or less. Because there are certain questions that you can ask that confirm step number one, that confirm step number two. Is this your experience? You don't. Some guys don't need the 6 hours to get up to a fourth step or 4 hours. Some do. But for me, I have to bring God into it because I don't want to interfere with that person's man or woman's way to find God. You know, that would be me playing God. I'm not allowed to do that. In 2005, I had an accident due to my arrogance that caused me to get shattered on the ground and lay dying on the ground over in New Jersey as a direct result from misjudging an altitude that I turned a parachute at. You know, I'm an experienced, to this day, I'm an experienced skydiver. I got 370 jumps behind my belt. I got 7 base jumps. I'm experienced. I could go out now. I don't do it anymore. I was told by a very good friend of mine, he's my base mentor, he's one of my best friends, he said, and he's also teaching me how to do this high performance thing, he said, David, go back to what I taught you in the beginning. You're being dangerous. And this is the guy I'm base jumping with, and that's like insane. Because there's no emergency chute. You impact the ground at 4 seconds or less when you jump off these objects. There's no emergency parachute, there's no reserve. You do it, and if you make a mistake, you die or get critically injured. Most of the time, the guy's dying. You know? And I didn't want to listen to him. You know, and I told him, I got this. You know? And next thing I know, I made a mistake. As soon as I turned, I knew it. And I hit the ground twice over 40 miles an hour, shattering my pelvis. I fractured my sacrum in two. I split my pelvis directly up one line all the way up it. You know, I broke both my feet. During that tumble and breaks, one of those bones punctured my femoral artery. And it bled for 2.5 hours before it stopped. There's a guy in med school that could probably tell you here, that's not possible. How can something do it? Well, I got medical records that show it did. They had to go up in my vein. I don't know how bad I was bleeding. They couldn't find it. I got a scar from here to here where they tried to cut me open. I didn't pass out. I could hear what was going on, but I never passed out. The next thing I know, I'm in like this. You know, if anybody watches The Sopranos when Tony was in the coma, that's what happened to me. I'm sitting there. I think I'm in some movie set in Philly in this abandoned warehouse district, and I'm like on the edge of this thing. And next thing I do, I come to out of this coma, and I got these big gloves on my hands, you know. And, you know, God, what the hell? It's just hell. I was paralyzed from the waist down, you know. I can't walk. I can't wipe myself. Yeah. I can't do a lot of things, you know. No, you get a kiss. Well, you got to give these guys a break. They actually came and stayed with me and lived this experience with me. They got the privilege of watching God work a miracle, you know, because what would happen after that is just it's a stone-cold miracle. I'm sitting at my house in a hospital bed, can't move, and they start bringing AA meetings to me. They also brought me a new guy to take through the steps. What a great experience that was, because it took my mind when he was there and I was taking him through the steps off of pain that fentanyl could not take away. You know? Terrible, terrible stuff. But when I was working with him, my mind wasn't focused on what was wrong with me. And what I believe happens is, in my experience, and what I believe the big book says in a general way, is that when we put our hands into our problems, we screw them up worse. But if we'll avert our attention and direct our attention to helping somebody else, God can get in there and do His miracle. This thing is so powerful. I was taking another guy through the steps, and I'm walking the meetings in a walker. You know, I can't walk, and I'm using this walker, and I got to take this guy through the steps. And I'm dreading this because during the entire meeting of that Monday night meeting, wonderful meeting that was over on Main Street, I'm sitting on my hands because I'm in so much pain because I'm off my narcotics. You know, and I know I'm going to be in pain, but I'd rather be off than be fogged. Because even at the minimum amount, I'm still fogged and I can feel it. So it was time for me to get off. And I'm in so much pain that I'm dreading taking this guy that we're going to spend an hour or so taking him through the steps. This is my experience. I sit in the truck with my friend and we start going through the deal. We invited God into it. And I start taking him through the steps. My pain left. Stays gone for over an hour. And then I'm riding back down Main Street. He parted, I parted, and all of a sudden my pain came back. Where'd it go? Explain that to me. There's a line in another good book that I believe says something to the effect that if it's in His way, He will remove it. If it's of no use to Him, and I'm referring to God. You know, I've had so many privileges of taking God's other kids and turning them on to this way of life that I'd have to talk till midnight to share some of the experiences that I have gotten through experience with some of God's kids that it's just truly wonderful. I've had the privilege of taking non-alcoholics through the steps. I do a lot of, because I'm disabled, I do a lot of online alcoholics, and they're not AA sanctioned stuff, but they're recovery, and they actually have AA meetings. And I was in this combined meeting where Al-Anon and AA get together every day. And this lady was sitting over there for months listening to me share. And then one day we're in a private conversation and she's talking about her life. And everybody in the room's telling her, you know, you ought to divorce that A. Because they call them an Al-Anon, they call us the A. They don't use our name. You know? They don't. I don't know for everybody in Al-Anon, but these people I ran into. And I asked her, I said, have you ever been through the step? What step are you on? She's been going to Al-Anon for 6 years. She goes, step six. I said, dear, in my experience, there's really no work at step six. It's a consideration. There's two questions to be considered. You know? Do I think God has the ability to remove everything that was blocking me from my four step? The next, am I willing to allow God to remove it? There's no work involved. It's considerations that I need to consider. Because there's an out in that sixth step. I got molested as a kid. I could sit there and bring that up and hold that against the people that did that to me. Because I may or may not play a part in that. The steps gave me an out in that. But because I didn't want to be blocked. I'm not saying that's for everybody, but I didn't want to be blocked. So I said, God, take it all. So I asked her, I said, would you like to go through the steps out of the book? She said, yes. And we went through the steps. What a wonderful experience. I was like, how am I going to do this, God? She's not an alcoholic. Trust God and help others. And He gave me that experience. She told me about 4 months ago on the phone, because I talk to her all the time, because she takes women and others in Al-Anon through the steps out of our big book. Because that's where the actual directions have not been corrupted. I don't know what the other programs and fellowships do, but we have clear-cut directions of those steps. And when you reword it, it's like baking a cake. You change the directions. You don't get the same results. I guarantee that. You don't get the same results. And this is what came out of her mouth. And I'll leave you with this. Well, I've got a couple minutes left. I'm almost done. Woo! She said, David, I got more out of going through the steps in 2 days with you than I did going to Al-Anon meetings for 6 years. Now that may not impress anybody in this room, but that impresses the hell out of me. Not for me, but what God had the ability to do through me. They say we may be the only example of this, of the big book, that people may meet. So what type of example am I living? How am I treating my family? How am I treating my kids? I get to take my kids swimming like 3 days a week. You know, I'm on disability. The Y gave us a discounted membership. $50 for 6 months. It's like, yeah! Because I get to take my kids swimming, and I need to swim because I got all the hardware out of my body because it was backing itself out and cutting through my organs. You know, I got 10 screws that were held in the front, 2 big screws held my sacrum them together, and they were backing themselves out. My body was rejecting the hardware. My pelvis hasn't healed. And they had to take it out in January. You know? And the doctor says, your pelvis may never, ever fully heal. But who are you to complain? You should be dead. You know, when the doctors tell you that there was something, and they don't come out and say it's God that was looking out for you, and not just one, like every one that I've seen, because when they look at my x-rays from the accident and the heart, my one orthopedist locally in Elston said, David, do you know how many people have died with your exact injuries in front of me on my operating table? See, I'm not supposed to be here. I mean, getting here was hell. But having that happen, it's like, I can't blow this opportunity. God gave me a gift, and it's to help other kids who are whatever packages that they're in. You know, and I had the privilege a week and a half ago, I got to hear Dr. Bob talk. You know, and he talked about how Bill brought the message to him, and there's stuff in there that ain't in the book. You know, and then he talked at the end, he talked about the four absolutes. Absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute love, and absolute purity. He said we can get absolute honesty, we can get absolute unselfishness, we can get absolute purity, but the one thing that none of us will ever be able to attain in his experience was absolute love. Because that's under the premise, if I can do absolute love, that means I can see God no matter where he's at in you, no matter what package he's coming at, because God comes in many different forms of packages, and a lot of them ain't pretty. Because they're twisted. But God's still in there. He said, but it doesn't, even though we can never achieve absolute love, he said, make no mistake, we can strive for it. Because that's what we're supposed to be doing. We've had death and misery averted in us. My God, I'm no longer powerless over alcohol. You ever look in the first step? Anybody see that? It said we admitted we were powerless. Not are. By the second step, it said lack of power. That's the dilemma. My God, if I get the power, I'm no longer powerless. Of my own, of course I am. But who do I work for? That third step prayer that I did, I've been saying it every day for 6 years, minus when I was in a coma. That's a covenant between me and God. God, that thing is living proof that he'll take away all my difficulties. Year number two's mistake that I made. Year number four's accident I had. Ask anybody that said, I remember there was a lady in here, I'll leave you with this. She had a dream. She goes, and this is when I was in a wheelchair. She goes, David, I dreamed that I saw you walking one day. What am I doing right now? And this is not for me, because I get the byproduct of what God does for me. But it's to show all of God's other kids the power of God's love and way of life if I do one thing. What does C say and how it works? God could and would if you were what? Bingo. And what does salt mean? Seek. All I got to do is seek. Thank you very much.